You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
As a young student, John Crocker embarked on the adventure of a lifetime, spending 8 months in the Gombe Forest working with Jane Goodall. He would follow families of wild chimpanzees from sunrise to sunset and learn the fundamental behavioral traits of these chimps as they raised their offspring. One chimpanzee in particular would captivate him. Her name was Fifi, and she displayed extraordinary patience and reassurance towards her infant, Freud. Upon returning home and becoming a doctor, Crocker found himself incorporating the lessons he learned from Fifi into his work as a father and physician. When he would witness his young patients rocketing around the exam room, he would picture Fifi's patience and tacit approval of Freud's uninhibited and joyful exploration. Following Fifi raises thought-provoking questions about the evolution of human behavior, the importance of patience, strong family bonds, and provide a greater understanding of what it means to be human. My name is Greg Bidet. You're listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Our special guest today is Following Fifi author John Crocker. We catch up with him at the Ninth Hotel.
I grew up in Portland, and then I moved away when I was 18. So I'm really, this is my hometown, Portland.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, this is it. Rose City, the Rose City area. My dad worked for Fred Meyer.
Don't tell me you're a Sounders fan, too.
Well, I might be.
It's a great book. I just finished it morning, actually.
Thanks.
Just wrapped up the book. Uh-huh. It's a book in three parts, and I'd like to break down, you know, the book into those three segments. And
good.
It begins with Babu.
Yeah.
I love the story of Babu.
Good.
With diapers. You're walking around with a gorilla in diapers.
It was a scene, yes. Because before I went to Africa, after I was accepted, but before I left, I had to prepare. And Babu, this two-year-old orphan chimp, whom I took care of, one afternoon a week for a year, he was probably the biggest part of my preparation in going to Africa. Because he taught me what it was like to be a chimp mother. I would take him on little outings, and he would be clinging to me, just like he would his mother, and wearing diapers.
I love this part of the book, by the way. It really sets the table, I think.
It was, for me, looking back, just such a coincidence. You know, first of all, it was a coincidence that I got to go to Africa and meet Jane and all that, Jane Goodall. But Babu really came out of the blue, just like the trip to Africa did, in that a couple that lived close to Stanford, where I was going to school, asked me if I would take care of him because they had a hard time as he got older and he became more aggressive. They had a hard time managing him and wanted someone to just take him out on outings so they could clean the house and do their errands. But during this time, you know, we bonded really closely.
Yeah.
And I really felt feelings of fatherhood because, you know, here he was in diapers and he would come to me for reassurance just like chimps in the wild would do with their mothers. And so I described in the book, this might be what you're referring to too, I described being in a park one afternoon when there were other children playing and fathers and mothers with their children. And Babu, in his diapers, was up in a tree swinging and doing his acrobatics. And when he became frightened, like when a dog barked, he raced down and would jump into my arms and hug me, hug my chest and tummy and just cling to me until he was reassured. And as I was doing that, a dad came up and just looked at me as Babu was clinging to me and I had his bottles and he paused and he said, "You sure have an ugly kid there." That was a moment for me when he said that. You know, I was very proud.
Babu lived to a ripe old age of 29.
Yes.
You know, I didn't realize chimps lived that long till reading this book. There's just not enough books about primatology.
Right.
I don't think it really gets its due.
I agree. In captivity, they've lived to be 70 years old and older. And at Gombe, where I was, Gombe's the name of the place where I worked, where Jane Goodall started in 1960. And there, the chimps, the average age was somewhere around late 30s, early 40s for longevity. But some lived to be 50, and the females would give birth even in their late 40s. So their fertility did not diminish.
Apparently Fifi was quite attractive into later age.
Yes, I think in terms of the word attractive, that's a really good word to use, because her mother, old Flo, had a torn ear and a bulbous nose, but even in her mid to late 40s, she was one of the most sought after chimps during the mating season for her. And so during estrus, she was attractive in a way.
Estrus.
Yes. So during her receptivity for mating, the females have a swelling, anogenital swelling, when they're receptive for mating about once a month. And so Flo, Fifi's mother, who was really tattered and torn and looked old, was just as sought after as any other female in the group. In fact, more, because she was sort of a lead female.
That's interesting. We have so much in common with the chimps. It's something that you talk about a lot in this book,
mm-hmm.
and it's not what I expected. It wasn't an academic book. It's very relatable.
Oh, thanks. I've tried to make it for the general reader, and I tried to include things like basic anthropology and behavior, but also to tell the story. It's all the information is told through the story of what it was like for me to be there in part one, to be with Jane and the chimps and what that was like. And then part two, which was the influence on me as a physician, where I gave cases, actual clinical cases. And then at the end, returning with my son and what that was like to go back 35 years later.
Incredible.
So I thank you for saying that, because I did try to make it into a book that was very readable and that wasn't just for scientists to read, but for the general reader. And to maybe get something from it that would help them in their life. In the clinical section in the middle, I talk about anxiety and how in my practice mm-hmm. I looked at anxiety from an evolutionary point of view.
Yes.
Based on how in the chimp society it's actually useful to have some anxiety.
Yes,
and with
absolutely.
ADD and other things. So I tried to include things that might help people, both in terms of the mental conditions we all experience and with depression and anxiety, but also in child rearing. So I tried to include things that, you know, from the old wise guy, this
yeah.
old wise guy me, who has been in practice in family medicine for 35 years and spent a year in the jungle with Jane Goodall, to try and share what I learned from all that, to put it together.
You mentioned in the book too this surreal feeling of a feeling like you're almost in a National Geographic film. You're there with Jane Goodall.
Yes. Oh, that's a good
pick
up too.
I've seen these films. These are fantastic films.
They are.
And
yeah,
18 months until Jane was even able to get close
yes.
enough to observe the chimps closely enough to really analyze what was going on.
Yes.
And I think at some point you mentioned, I know you did, mm-hmm. This surreal feeling of oneness and this sort of out of body experience.
Mm-hmm. I did. It seemed like a dream at times, that it wasn't real. I remember distinctly, even now I can think back and I can feel that feeling of like somebody's, like I'm in a movie, but it's not really me. I'm just watching the movie. And I think it's because there was so much history there. You know, there was history of Jane starting in 1960. I was there in 1973. And 13 years before is when she set foot in this, at Gombe, the name of the
yes.
place. And Louis Leakey, you know, was the one who got her there.
Yes.
Yeah, he really started her, and Diane Fossey started
That's right.
her.
Diane yeah. Fossey, yes.
And so I think...
Gorillas in the Mist.
Yes, Gorillas in the Mist. But I think that knowing that history, knowing of Louis Leakey, you know, starting Jane off in 1960 when she was there just with her mother, and like you said, this long period of time that it took for the chimps to accept her, I think that's what I felt when I was there in these valleys. I went up to the peak where Jane first started looking and observing the chimps from way up high, so she could see them, but they wouldn't be afraid of her. And so when I went to the peak, I thought, oh my gosh, this is what I saw in the movies.
And National Geographic, yes. Now, Jane wrote the foreword. You gave Jane an initial draft of this book. And how did she help you?
It was great. You know, I have to tell you, along with my confidence in all areas of life, I was so nervous because I had heard about the author of the book about Julia Childs. And when the author gave it to Julia Childs to read, Julia Childs was really upset and said, this is a disgusting book. And anyway, I was nervous. So when I gave it to Jane, I was waiting for the response. I gave her the manuscript before it went to print. And right. I could even read you what she said in the book, because this kind of says a bit about her and how gracious a person she is. So she read the manuscript on her 80th birthday and wrote back and said, what would you like me to do? And I said, well, what about a foreword? And here's what she said in the last paragraph of the foreword. She said, John, I want to thank you for writing this. I have loved reading your accounts of your hours with Fifi and Freud, Melissa and Greblin, Figgin and Mike. It has taken me back to another era, before I started my life on the road as a conservationist, before you were plunged into the sometimes unbearable workload of the family doctor in today's world. Yeah, she got that one right. See, I mean, she just gets it. Not only did it take me back to Gombe, but also reading it made me reflect on how Gombe influenced my life, too. There are parts of the book that talked about her relationship with her first husband, and when I was there,
oh yes,
she was getting to know her second husband, and so
there were things. Love was in the air.
Yes, it was a very romantic
spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was 39, I was 22, and
you must have had a crush on her. You must have.
I think it was the magic of being there and with the chimps and with her was so overwhelming that I didn't know what I had a crush on.
Well, we all fell in love with Jane Goodall watching these films, and she was a pioneer.
This is kind of personal, but she admits that she was kind of a cover girl for National Geographic. Now, that's kind of a superficial thing, because that's kind of just what she looked back upon and said, I guess I looked pretty good on the cover. But in fact, it was so much more than that. I mean, Jane she's so smart and she's so intuitive, and going against the grain to name the chimps and talk about their personalities, you know, upset the whole scientific community. Yet that's what allowed people to read and to learn and to watch the movies and learn about the chimps, was the fact that she didn't number them. And that she talked about their personalities. And
yeah, I had to giggle at these names that she right. came up with for the chimps. Like Freud obviously conjures up images of an elderly gentleman talking about sex.
Yeah,
so
right.
Quite funny. Okay, so.
Yes, no, it does. And so the names, she picked a lot of the names, and some of the students got to pick some. But I think the, you know, you had said that dreamlike state of being there, and I think sometimes I even pictured when I was with the chimps, you know, I would follow families of chimps from sunrise to sunset each day, so that's a long time being with chimps and watching and recording. I would use a tape recorder and do on the minute observations, and yet I never really got tired of watching their behavior, because it was so interesting, and I just became so involved in watching the mothers build nests and watch the infants watch and learn how to do that, and so that time of just observing, I think, really affected me later as a physician, even when I would listen to the stories that my patients told me, and that would, it's sort of a similar mindfulness or focus, because you, when you're in the room with a patient, you really have to focus on what they're saying and listen to the details. It's like a detective. You know, you have to figure out the story and listen to everything. You can't be thinking of what you didn't do in the morning and what you might want to do in the future, because you have to not only listen and watch and learn from the patient, but you have to be designing a treatment plan, and all within, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. So I think from watching the chimps and learning from Jane, I think I learned more to just observe during that time than to do a lot of talking.
A very funny moment in the book is when a centipede made its way into your dwelling.
Yeah, that was the first night.
Very funny.
Yeah, first night in my hut. You know, here I was, I'd gone from living in dorms, packed dorms, to having my own hut.
Stanford, right.
Yes, right, at Stanford. And suddenly I'm off into this hut, and you can't even see other people or other huts. It was in the middle of the forest, and people had warned me about centipedes, and they said those are more dangerous than scorpions, that they're big and shiny. And so the first night when I was getting ready to go to bed, one crawled up through the crack in the cement and started crawling across the floor. So I smashed it with a jar, and both halves started crawling. And that's what I don't know if you saw Fantasia.
Yes.
Yeah, so in Fantasia, when all the buckets would multiply in the wise, it was just like that. I was really in panic mode. I had never been camping before I went on this voyage, and so all of a sudden, I'd loved the outdoors, but I never did a lot of camping or really exploring more than just going to parks and things like that. So it was a time for me when I was exposed to nature 24/7, either out following in the forest or at night, hearing all the storms and the rain through the screens of the hut.
Right.
Just with it all the time.
Also, back to Babu, another funny incident is when you talked about you were in your 63 Mustang with Babu the monkey.
Yes.
I couldn't even imagine what that,
the reaction
must have gotten.
Right. So when Babu was sitting in the front seat, of course, we didn't have seat belts, so he was crawling all over. But when we would stop at stop signs, the car next to us would look over, and Babu would be staring back at them. And it always, you could
like
see.
The Clint Eastwood movie.
Right. And, you know, I will say this, that bond I had with him was probably, as close a bond as I formed with many of the human friends that I've made over the years, because of how endearing that was. And it was really hard. Our departure was really hard. It was so ironic, because when I left to go to Africa.
I mean, you followed his life.
Right, I did.
Years and years and years.
And I couldn't follow it by seeing him, because I knew when I went off to Africa, he was going to go into this compound with other chimps, which was the right thing. But I still felt, I felt it was ironic that he was going to go to Stanford and be in a compound while I flew off to Africa to see what his life would have been like in the wild. But what happened to Babu was interesting, because he ended up being used for research. And he was very instrumental in coming up with a vaccine for hepatitis B, because he acquired that from other chimps when he was put in the compound. Yeah. And that's how he died, was in research experiments. And so he would have lived probably another 15 years had he not been part of this experimentation. He did have a good life. He fathered children, and he was taken care of very well. But it was still, you know, we have to give him credit for being part of the success of a vaccine, but also giving his life for it.
What else I loved was your comments about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with Hamisi.
Yeah.
I loved the fact that you sort of took from it that maybe it isn't about hitting the peak, maybe it's about enjoying the journey.
Exactly. Well, and you know, this was a big deal to go on a three-week trip with one of the field assistants from Gombe. Mostly that was the Tanzanian research assistants, and they were all guys in their 20s. They stayed in their village and they worked, but it wasn't common for a researcher or student to take one of them and offer them a trip. And so I had arranged for us to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, partly because I really wanted to, I really liked this guy as a friend.
Right.
I liked all of them, but I mean, we became very close friends. And so climbing the mountain together was a big deal. He made it to the 15,000 foot mark, but didn't make it to the top because of the altitude sickness. Right. And so, yes, afterwards, I thought about how enjoyable it was being with him and going up to the 15,000 Mark, and how unenjoyable it was to be totally nauseated, to go to the peak and be nauseated and not see anything when I got up there and be freezing cold.
I love that because you never hear people say that.
Yeah.
It was, makes me feel better about not reaching a peak.
Good. No, I just thought, you know, I know that a lot of times reaching the peak of anything, the peak in life, some peak that you want to do, it's not even a mountain, but reaching some goal is important, but this was the journey that became important. And especially with Hamisi, the journey we did together was much more important. And how we interacted, the first time that he saw snow in his whole life, I got to experience that. He picked up snow and held it up to his
right.
face. And it was
funny.
Just to see him, to watch his expression of touching snow for yeah. the first time. It was so that was more about relationship than conquering a mountain. I think you were very observant to pick that up, that really it showed me, looking back and even at the moment, I could feel that was the most important.
I'm just curious, mm-hmm. why did you write this book? Did you feel like you had to?
Good
after
point.
All these years?
Mm-hmm. I started writing it 10 years ago at a writer's retreat for Stanford alumni. And I just had the idea of writing about my experience of working with Jane Goodall and the chimps. But it evolved, and I'm glad it did, into more of a book about how it influenced me as a physician and father. Because it really did. And in writing the book, I reflected a lot on how it did that.
That's what makes this book very unique from any other
yeah.
primatology book out there.
I think it does. And I
had it related so much to yeah. humans, especially as a physician.
So I have to tell you, though, it was a huge hesitation to add in the medical part because I was working 12-hour days. And the last
yes,
thing
right about this.
It was so intense. And the last thing I wanted to do at the end of the day was write about medicine. I wanted to go into this escape mode and talk about the chimps and think about the chimps.
It's mentally exhausting.
Oh, yes. And that was always my escape while I did medicine was when I was completely overwhelmed with the number of patients I had to see and the time limits and the computer emailing patients, I would think about the chimps. It would be my escape. So when it was suggested by Brenda Peterson that I really, you know, a lot of people have worked with primates and they've done this, but very few have the combination of having a medical practice and talking about how that fits. So I did then finally got enthused about including clinical cases. And I think the two areas that I found...
And you do in mm-hmm. this book. You
yes.
have specific cases.
They are. I changed the names to protect them, but I talk about anxiety in a patient, and I relate that to what I learned from the chimps, and also ADD.
I also enjoyed the... you know, your personal thoughts about imagining people in a different time and
yes,
space.
I did that a lot.
And doing very well in those environments, right. but maybe not so much in modern day.
Right. So Robert, who came to me with anxiety, was a classic case, and we dealt with his anxiety. But I also pictured him being a castle guard
yes.
in the Middle Ages, where that anxiety would be channeled into guarding, you know, right. pacing at night. And yet Robert was in a... You know, he commuted, was strapped into his seat in the car. He was
that
behind
Seattle
the computer.
Seattle traffic will get
yeah,
you every
exactly.
time.
That you can understand road rage. And so I would picture chimps like Figgin, who paced the perimeter of Gombe.
Right.
And
yes.
it was important for him to have this vigilance or anxiety about the intruders that could be. And so he was like a guard, and he would be patrolling. His hair sometimes would go
right.
out with these bursts of adrenaline and this, the pant hoot. You could just let that, and that would just echo out. And his hair would be erect and he'd charge. And then he would kind of settle down and maybe groom or touch another chimp and be calm, but he'd still be in motion. And yet, when I looked at the case of Robert, who really, we didn't know why he was so anxious. We tried to understand if there was some event, but he probably was genetically predisposed to be an anxious person.
I would like to talk about part three of the book, which is the which is quite emotional on many levels. The return to Gombe.
Yes.
After, my goodness, was it 36 years?
36 years. Goodness. Yeah.
And you meet your buddy.
Yeah, my buddy Hamisi that climbed the mountain with me.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was your guide, and now you're visiting him again.
Right. And I went to his village when I was there as a student and went back to his village 36 years later.
Yes.
I took my son, which was huge because...
Tommy.
Tommy came with me and he was 22. He was 20.
And Patrick was just too young.
He was too young. My younger son was too young.
You think you might take him next time?
Yes, I'd love to. And he would love it.
There's a picture of Tommy bouncing around in this book. By the way, the photography in this book, gorgeous.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it.
Gorgeous.
It took a lot to dig up pictures, and some were sent, but a lot of them were ones I took back then.
Yeah, it really helps conjure those images in your mind when you're reading the passages of you and Gombe. So you're back with him, you say, and...
Yes.
You're with your son this time.
Well, we actually met Jane in Dar es Salaam on the way in.
Right.
So we had this evening at her house on the Indian Ocean with the mango trees and the reminiscing, sipping whiskey. Thomas and I were both there with her, and it was a magical night because part of going back was to
was sort he 21?
He was 20. Yeah. Oh, sorry, 20. First time to sip whiskey.
How old do you have to be to drink that?
Oh, gosh, in Africa, probably 5. I don't know.
Having whiskey
with Jane.
It can
flow
Jane.
In and out. So we were talking about the chimps. And one thing that struck me at that moment, as we were sitting together, I think it took whiskey to get me to relax. Because even though I know Jane and I've been with her and she's a friend, I'm still a little uptight about it.
You mentioned that.
Yes, and like my dad, he would always be worried in a social situation that he sort of had to control it. And I was feeling that. Tommy, my son, was just... talking away to Jane. Jane was engaged.
Isn't that the age, though? Isn't that just the age, really? I mean, you were probably a lot different at 20 years old. Maybe.
I think I was a little more self-conscious.
Really?
I just felt like...
Sort of a genetic thing, you think?
I think so. Maybe. Part of it was age. But I think watching Thomas interact with Jane, and Jane is so honest. She doesn't cover up anything. What she says is from her heart, and she doesn't mince words. She's brutally honest. And Tommy is, too. So... to see them talking, I learned a lot. And just sitting there and feeling the evening flow and talking about Gombe, and Tony was there, who's in charge of the baboons and was in charge of the whole camp at one time. We were all together. But having Thomas there on the return trip meant so much to me, and I learned from him.
The exact same age as you.
Exactly.
Incredible.
Yes, and he looks like me. So it was
incredible. Yes, you mentioned
that. It was startling to kind of picture him and the fact that I was
like a young Bill Walton.
Yo, that's...
Everybody says that, really? Who I've shown this book to.
Uh-huh. Bill Walton. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, the other thing about going back...
70s Bill Walton.
Oh, that's 70s?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's good. The listeners can kind of picture what we look like. But the arrival at the camp was something that I was... Just as I was nervous about giving the book to Jane, I was really tense about going back because, you know, what would it be like? It's like going to a high school reunion. Would it be that some of the same people were there, or would it look different?
Just so much time has passed.
36 years. So when the boat landed, I saw no one except someone that came up to help us out of the boat, and they were so disinterested in our being there. And it was, and then...
You even said, is this Gombe at some point?
It didn't look the same. Yeah. It had overgrown, and there was some funny little sign up. And then I looked down the beach. As I stepped out of the boat, I looked down the beach. And I pointed. I said, is that Hamisi?
Yeah.
And they said, yes. And so as he walked towards me and I walked towards him, I was just building this, you know, excitement. And we had the longest hug I've had in a long time. It was a
male
human.
Male-on-male hug.
Yes, it was a great hug. It's the way we interacted that, I don't know if you have friends that you feel you just know, you just get it with each other. You don't even have to say something. You just get it. And he and I just got each other. Maybe because we had different languages. I spoke some Swahili and he spoke Swahili. We each had a first language, mine English and his Kiha. But the fat, maybe that helped us just to connect on a whole different level. You know, looking, touching, just, you know, knowing as we...
Many hours together.
Right. In the
many hours
of following chimps. And he was someone who was so tuned in. He was so sensitive to finding the animals, and I learned so much from him. And he was my protector. And he was sort of like my mom in that he could tell when I was getting tired. He would almost, know when I wasn't
just
feeling
pick up on it.
Yeah. So anyway, the reunion was amazing.
He's the wise man now of his community.
He is. And he...
Still working?
He's still working. And he was the medicine man, too. He studied plant medicine.
Right.
So we both had similar kind of things.
And at the end of the book, you mentioned the coffee...
Yes.
I can't even imagine how great this Tanzanian coffee is.
Oh, it's so good.
And it's sustainable coffee,
it
too.
Is. And that's Jane really took the bull by the horns in 1986. Could have been 88, but late 1980s. She flew over Gombe, the 10-by-3-mile national park, and saw this beautiful green little postage stamp view of Gombe, surrounded by land that had just been stripped and destroyed by refugees who had to make a living. And so she started really rewarding the villagers to grow coffee sustainably and to grow trees instead of cutting down all the trees to grow tree farms for wood. And it's made a huge difference.
It's a very upbeat ending to the book. How long did this take to write this entire book? The whole 10 years?
My life was pretty busy with practice and family, so I had to get the book in when I could. So that's why it took long. And I also, after I had the first draft, I felt like it was really important to make it better through talking to other editors and writers. But over the course of the time I was writing, I also really appreciated being able to take time to reflect. You know, I'm very purpose-driven.
It's a very reflective book, very. Yes. Surprisingly so.
They say, you know, I was late 50s, early 60s when I wrote it. So they say the 60s are a time of reflection. And for me...
Really? They say that?
They say that. I don't know if it's true, but they say that when you're in your 60s, it's a good time that people tend to start reflecting more. I don't know if that's true, but...
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. But for me, since I am so purpose-driven, I would not have done that. I don't think, you know, I always want to, like, get stuff done, finish the dishes, do the laundry, you know, do the... see my patients, get that work done, get my family stuff done. And so to have something where I had to reflect, I mean, I enjoyed reflecting. It gave me that permission sort of to do that. Being in the forest, it sort of opens things up. You know, you talked about, you know, the idea of being older. When we finished watching a chimp build his nest, when Tommy and I and Abdul is our leader, in the forest on the return trip, when we watched this chimp build his nest, go to sleep at night, and we went down to the beach, there was this moment where I felt like, yes, this is the next generation that's here. You know, I felt like I had my time here.
Right.
And the forest makes things, you know, like getting older, seem so natural, and it makes it seem not so scary. Watching the chimps gives you a feeling of, you know, the passing seasons and the next generation and how that works.
And also how the alphas come and go. I mean, the alphas, you're not an alpha forever.
Right, exactly.
You know, and you're tested.
Uh-huh.
And this is relatable to human beings in that respect, because I think sometimes in relationships, you will get tested by your mates.
That's right.
You know, it may not be politically correct to say, but there's often an alpha beta relationship, you know, with men and women.
Yes.
In research for this book, did you read any of Jane's materials?
Jane has some good ones. A Reason for Hope and Seeds for Hope. She's real big on hope. When she ends her lectures, she always says, you know, that she always leaves people with a feeling of hope. And she's so good at that. And in her books, and she talks about that. And she'll get into something like botany, and then she'll write a book on it. She's written many, many books. And in her talks, she does the same thing.
All bestsellers.
Yes. She does so well with that. She, at the end of her speeches, she always looks out at the audience and she says, you know, each of you can make a difference in this world, and you can choose what kind of difference that will be. And then she'll say, and when an opportunity comes that is important to you, you should definitely take that. And
Steve Irwin said the same thing.
Yes, that's
almost
right.
Almost verbatim.
Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome, and thank you for your interest and just your knowledge from reading the book, and I really appreciate that a lot. Thank you, Gregory, a lot.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. My name is Gregory Day. We will see you next week. Please join me. Why?